Welcome to the Making Sense Podcast. This is Sam Harris. Today I'm speaking with Cass Sunstein. Cass is the most cited legal scholar in the U.S., and from 2009 to 2012, he served as the administrator of the White House Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs. Since then, he served in various capacities in the U.S. government and advised many nations, as well as the United Nations, the Asian Development Bank, and the World Health Organization. He is a professor at Harvard Law School and the co-author of several interesting books, Nudge, Noise, and his latest, which he wrote with Tali Sharot, is Look Again, The Power of Noticing What Was Always There. And today, Cass and I speak about the book. We talk about habituation and its consequences, the way we habituate to positive and negative experiences. We discuss things like marriage and happiness and meaning and variety, doing good versus feeling good, midlife crises, having kids, wealth and happiness, things versus experience. And then we pivot to topics of more political relevance. We talk about the illusory truth effect, misinformation and social media, echo chambers and extremism, what governments can do to respond to misinformation, free speech on college campuses, the 2024 presidential election, and other topics. And now I bring you Cass Sunstein. I am here with Cass Sunstein. Cass, thanks for joining me again.
Thanks for having me. A great pleasure.
So there's a lot to talk about, some of which is contained in your new book. So I think we'll start there. The book which you wrote with Tali Sharot is Look Again, The Power of Noticing What Was Always There, which is focused on this kind of fascinating problem. And I mean, in some ways it's a problem. I guess in other ways it's an advantage. But the problem of habituation and what to do about it. I mean, we habituate to both good and bad things. And you'd think that habituating to bad things would be good, but certainly not always. How do you think about this? What is habituation?
Okay, so suppose you're going into the ocean, and in the first seconds, it's horrible. It's really cold. And you're thinking, why am I going into the ocean to freeze myself? And then after a few seconds, it's cold. And then a little while later, it's okay. And then a little while later, come on in, the water's fine. Many things are like that, meaning we have shown diminishing sensitivity to stimuli. So if you go into a room and there's some smell, maybe someone smoking, maybe there's a dog who had a moment, you will smell the smell and think this is really stinky. And then after 20 minutes, chances are you won't notice it. Right now, there may be a noise in the room where you are, and you're not noticing it because you've habituated to it. And that's kind of how our species is. And in fact, that's how all living creatures are. The more we're exposed to things, the less sensitive we are to them.
Yeah, so just neurologically speaking, we have these internal models of how our perceptual state should be, is expected to be. It's just a predictive coding routine, both with respect to perception and our behavioral engagement with the world. And when things conform to our predictions, our responses to them, their salience becomes inhibited and things just begin to fade. And we tend to notice errors and, you know, prediction errors. And again, this can be, you know, to positive or negative stimuli. On the face of it, habituation to negative things sounds like it would be good. What's the potential problem with that?
Well, it's good in many ways. I can't fly. I don't have wings. And I also can't make the Olympic basketball team. And neither of those is making me suffer.
Not anymore?
Never could I make the Olympic basketball team. And I never thought, oh my gosh, surprise, I'm not going to make it. I habituated early to the fact that I can't fly and I can't do what Michael Jordan and Kobe Bryant and LeBron James can do. So to habituate to something that just you can't do has many advantages. It means you're not having a surprise signal that deflates and demoralizes you every moment that your winglessness attaches you to the ground. But with respect to something bad, it may be that there's something that can be changed and that is kind of not good in the world or in your life that you habituate yourself to, that you live with and don't even, you know, form a sour face. You just think it is what it is. My nominee for the worst phrase in the English language, it's terrible, but it's the phrase of the habituating creature. It is what it is. And if you're living with, let's say, someone who's really mean at the workplace, you might get used to it. So after a couple of weeks, you don't notice it so much, but still the person is really mean. Or if you're in a town that has dirty water or a high level of crime, or let's say corruption, something that is bad for you and bad for the community, the fact that it's a little like cold water whose coldness you don't notice after a while, that means it's going to stay there when it may not be inevitable.
Yeah, well, there are some things that I fear we're habituating to in our politics and public life that I will bring up in a while with you because you are, you're an expert on those topics. But before we get there, what are you, so having written this book, are you doing anything differently in your life, or is it born of anything you have been doing differently in your life so as to increase the sense of novelty and accentuate your pleasures and minimize your pains? How are you applying this to your actual experience?
Well, the most immediate thing is I'm on book tour, and the book produced a book tour, and that's new for me.
And incredibly painful?
No, I'm loving it, and I get to talk to you, so thank you. No, I mean, it's a fantastic, you know, stroke of luck that people want to hear about this or are willing to hear about this. So that's an experience that doesn't have habituation in it. But in terms of my own life, I look at my children and my dogs as since I've been working on this book with a sense of discovery and amazement. And while I adored my children and my dogs too for since the day I first got to see all four of them and my bigger daughter, so five of them, the fact that I can see them as a miracle rather than just part of life is occasioned by the book. So Julia Roberts, the actor, is a hero of the book. She said in an interview pretty recently while we were in the midst of writing the book that her favorite day, her best day, is when she makes food for her kids, she makes the breakfast, then she has lunch with her husband, and she stops herself and says, it's boring. But then she adds, because of my job, I go away, I come back to my family life, and it's surrounded by pixie dust. It resparkles. And that notion of resparkling with respect to, you know, I get to have a place to live that's nice enough, and I get to, my job is mostly teaching. I see these things with more a sense of amazement than, you know, that's life, partly because of the book.
Mm. Yeah, one of your experts in the book, Esther Perel, sounds like she's recommending that people actually strategically take some separation from one another, you know, romantically, so as to kind of revivify the connection. I mean, so whether it's a night or a weekend or you know, a business trip or whatever it is, you know, there's something about, you know, it is the obvious cliche, you know, absence makes the heart grow fonder, but she's claiming that it does, and we sort of ignore that at our peril.
She has something very specific to say, and I should say that I met Esther Perel because I was at a wedding, and to see her at a wedding is pretty remarkable because she writes about marriage and some of the...
It's like seeing the Grim Reaper at a wedding.
That's right. A little ominous. Though. Yeah. She's a very nice and upbeat person. And at the dinner, we talked a bit about marriage, and her focus is on the deadening of romantic sparks. And so her great line is, fire needs air. Mm. And that's because people habituate to everything, including an amazing person you get to live with. So she says when members of couples are most attracted to each other, and this is based on her experience, it's often they see each other across a crowded room talking to somebody else. And that's because that dishabituates you. The person isn't just the person you live with. The person is, in some respects, a stranger, And then you think, my gosh, that's amazing. And this is true of general things in life, good things, which may be there's no air between us and them. And that makes us like them. They can be comfortable and pleasant, but they don't have a sense of sparkle. There's no pixie dust around them.
How do you apply these insights, if you do, to your conception of your own life, your career at this point, and whatever goals you have, or you know, explicit or implicit? I mean, there's certainly some wisdom to be extracted here with respect to how we think about human flourishing and the relationship of things like wealth and success to that, you know, ambition. I mean, what, you know, if you could go back in time and talk to your whatever 20-year-old self, you know, at some point where you probably were not as informed as you are now, what would you say about the importance of wealth and success and having a career that not only brought you those two things, but something that was more in line with a vocation, something that was directly tapping you into meaning? You know, because you have a, you know, I will have properly introduced you before we started talking here, but you have a many, many irons in the fire. You know, I think are often described as the most cited legal scholar in the country. And you've served in government. You have been a creature of the university. You have written and co-written a number of books on diverse topics that would seem to be just you following your intellectual interests into fun spaces. So you're doing a lot, and you have experienced a lot of success. You have been surrounded by successful, powerful people. What lessons can you draw about all that?
Well, I think I'd be very cautious talking to my younger self on the ground that my younger self would have a perspective that I lack, and I might kind of screw him up. But if he would listen to me, and since he is me, he probably would, though with a sense of the surreal science fictional quality of it, I'd say follow the path you think best. You probably will make some not terrible choices. But I guess I'd add something I know, which is that there are three things that people really care about. One is that they're happy, meaning that the days are smile-producing rather than tear-producing, that they're enjoying days, they're not feeling scared or anxious. But that's not the only thing. People also want to have a sense of meaning. So if you have a day where you're, you know, scowling a fair bit, not smiling a whole lot, but you're doing something that you consider valuable and honorable, it makes you feel you're contributing, that might be not a very happy day, but it might be a super meaningful day. And the idea of trying to seek both happiness and meaning is one I think my younger self didn't get that well. I think my younger self probably was a little low on the meaning side and a little higher on the happiness side. That person happened to luck into meaning, but it wasn't sought. Maybe there's a lesson there. But there's a third thing, which I think your question gets at, which recent data puts in a big font, which is that people need psychological richness too, meaning variety in their life. So if you have someone who has really happy life and it's full of meaning, if it's the same thing over and over again, both the happiness and the meaning are going to get less colorful over time. So if you spend 10 years, let's say, doing cancer research, which is incredibly meaningful, you may think I'm going to do 11 and 12 and 13 and 14 years also on that. But it may be that the sense of amazement that you have that you get to do it diminishes and even evaporates. And so people will sacrifice happiness and meaning for the sake of variety. And I've been lucky to have a fair bit of variety, that even now I have some role in government as well as some role as an academic. And so on Monday, I might be trying to figure out something about the Constitution. And on Thursday, I might be able to participate in a process where we're trying to solve some very concrete problem. And one's theoretical and abstract, and the other is intensely, in the next 2 days, how we're going to handle this. And they're very different mindsets, and I'm smiling because the skill set is so different. But it may be that I'm thrilled to do both because I get to do both.
Yeah, I'm struck by the distinction between the good we do in the world and the way it feels to do such good or to do anything. And those are often not at all coupled to one another, which is to say you could write a very large check to an organization that's saving lives in the most efficient way possible, and your experience of writing that check could be one of just total distraction and a lack of salience, right? You just, you've decided to write the check. You know, in the abstract, you support this organization, but you're just dashing off this philanthropy as you go about your day, and you never really take the time to reflect on the place you now occupy in a causal chain of goodness that really is saving lots of lives. Whereas maybe in that same day, and I kind of speak from experience now, having compared these things in my life a lot, you might be on a walk and someone's got a flat tire on their bicycle and you help them fix it, right? And so it's a 10-minute exchange with a stranger, which is wholly positive. But when you look at what gladdens your mind at the end of the day, it's going to be the fixed bicycle tire and that exchange, much more than the check to the organization that might have actually saved thousands of lives. And yeah, I'm obviously not suggesting we should make a choice between those things, because we're not forced to. But it would be nice if the most meaningful things we did were almost by definition the most rewarding things we did. I mean that's the kind of circle of incentives you wish you could achieve psychologically, I think.
It's a great point. So what I'm thinking is the relationship between what you said and habituation. So making out a check isn't something that sends a surprise signal to the human mind. So it's something that people do. You make out a check. So if you make out a check to pay your electricity bill, that's the same act as making out a check, let's say, that will transform some number of lives. And the act doesn't make you think, oh my gosh. And everything depends in terms of our brain's alertness on whether there's a surprise signal or not. If you go and help some stranger who's having a struggle with a bicycle or a struggle getting into a building or something, that's probably the only time you did that day, or maybe that week.
Yeah, or that decade. Yeah.
Over that decade. And so that the surprise signal is just a jolt, and of the best way. So if someone says something that really amazes you, that either hurts your feelings a lot or that makes you feel, great, then that's big in terms of your head. Not like you're going to get conceited, but you're going to get rewarded. And that's part of it. It's also part of it is that there's the personal, of course, we're wired to react to. So if you just send some check, piece of paper that goes to 17 people, let's say you'll never meet, that's not going to generate the same reaction as if you do something with one human being who looks you in the eye and says, thanks, or I'm glad you're here.
Do you have any thoughts specific to midlife? I mean, if you're talking not to your 20-year-old self, but to your mid-career self, or let's say your 40, 45-year-old self, is there anything that would have been important to communicate at that point?
Well, of course, I'm much younger than 40. So when I think of my 40-year-old self, I think that's really an old guy, and I hope he can still run.
Well, I'm still waiting to see you in the NBA.
But I do know something about midlife crisis because we studied it for purposes of the book.
Yeah.
There are midlife crises all over the world, not everywhere, but in many nations. It's kind of shocking. It's generality. And it happens at different ages, but it's the same phenomenon. And we have a theory of what accounts for the midlife crisis. It's that once you are, let's say, 40, it may be that life is really good, but nothing's changing. It's gray. So you have maybe a partner or maybe a community. It's the same. You have a job. It's good. It's steady. You have a place where you're living. That's kind of where you live. And this is a little like, I'm going to phrase it very strongly, but a little like being dead in terms of the mind. when you're 20, you can fall in love tomorrow. You can have your heart broken that night. You can learn something that's going to completely reorient where you're going. You can think, now I'm going to go to a place, maybe in the United States, maybe elsewhere, that I've never been before. And my gosh, what would it be like to see Los Angeles?
Mm.
Whereas if you're 40 or 50, the chance that you've seen Los Angeles is higher. And the idea that Los Angeles is going to make you amazed, the very prospect of Los Angeles, that's just lower. So for people in midlife crises, it's often like you're in a world where you have what you want, and there might be happiness, there might be meaning, I hope so, but psychological richness might not be present. People who are older, by the way, when their kids have left maybe, they're not sure where they're going to live. They might take up a hobby. They might retire and do something different. They might stay in their job and do something different. No midlife crisis anymore. The world is their oyster.
Hmm. Well, how much of that has to do with kids? You just sounded like you were celebrating the empty nester phase.
Well, there are a couple of things to say. So it turns out that taking care of small kids, people do take a happiness hit, that taking care of, they might have a meaning boost, but happiness goes down. And one thing about taking care of kids is there are lots of surprises, and so habituation is less likely. Keep in mind, habituation is diminished sensitivity to a stimuli that stays constant or changes very slowly.
Mm.
I have an 11-year-old and a 14-year-old, and there are lots of surprises. They're not like 2-year-olds and 4-year-olds, so it's not, you know, it's not like that, but there are lots of surprises. For people who have empty nest, there are, along one dimension, more surprises for many, meaning you can do whatever you want now. You can, you know, travel. You can go to, you know, Munich if you want, if you have the resources. And if you don't have the resources, you can take a little vacation an hour away, maybe, and see a town that's charming and that you've never seen before. And the fact of going and changing is in some ways more available to the empty nesters than to the nested.
How does this relate to the connection between wealth and happiness? How do you think about that? And there's a dichotomy, which at some point you discuss in your book, of experiences versus things, being the things that one might get with wealth. What is wealth good for when we're talking about human flourishing beyond the obviously the basics of just not being poor and having to deal with acute financial stress continuously?
Okay, we know a lot about this, more probably than humanity ever has. So as you say, being really poor is very bad. Everything gets worse. Weekends that have stress in them are worse if you're poor. Something involving health is worse if you're poor. Everything is worse, basically, population-wide, if you're poor. The recent data suggests that more money is just better. It's not hugely better, but it's definitely better, both in terms of how well people evaluate their lives, asking how happy are you, and in terms of measured experience. It keeps getting better up to, there may be a ceiling, but up to very large sums, people get happier, not a whole lot, but definitely happier with more money, except the bottom 20%. So the bottom 20% in terms of happiness, they are not going to do better when they are earning $200,000 versus when they're earning $90,000. They do better up to $70,000, by the way. But after that, if you're in the bottom 20% in terms of happiness, the difference between $220,000 and $80,000 is basically zero. And what's going on with them? We don't know exactly. But the most plausible account is if you're suffering from, let's say, anxiety or bereavement or depression, to have $80,000 versus $10,000, that's good. But to have $80,000 versus $200,000 doesn't matter a whole lot.
Mm.
So wealth matters less to well-being over $70,000 than one might think, but it is definitely a positive. Having said that, suppose you have a pot of money you just get, you know, some number of dollars, let's say $500. Do you want to spend that on getting a product, maybe a new laptop, maybe a television, or do you want to spend it on an experience, maybe a night or two in some place? Experiences tend to produce more happiness than products. And this is a little startling because a product, if you get a new TV, you can have that forever. If you have one or two nights away, you just have that for one or two nights. The reason appears to be that people habituate to products. So I have a new and better TV now. This is actually an autobiographical statement. I do, than I did 2 years ago. But is my life better, even in terms of TV watching, than it was with the old pretty good TV? Not much. I habituate to the new, better TV. With the experience, you have it, if it's short-term particularly, it's a boost for you, and you remember it. So people don't habituate to experiences and that are short-term for sure, and they remember them. So you think of products as the gift that keeps on giving. It's less true than intuition suggests, and you think of experience as ephemeral. That's also less true than intuition suggests. Experiences are actually the gift that keep on giving.
Yeah. I guess there are probably some material objects that bridge those two things. I'm thinking of something like, you know, having a great gym or something, like, you know, like something you use a lot, which actually changes you as a person on some level. I mean, it gives you a new, you know, sense of well-being or competence. Or let's say you get into cycling, you know, getting the bike that allows you to get into cycling is probably more than just a product. It becomes a new hobby. And so there's maybe corner conditions where it look like exceptions here, but
completely.
Yeah.
Completely. I'm thinking as you talk that I actually joined a gym in DC, which I dearly love. I didn't take up a new sport. I do my usual sport, which is squash. But my first days visiting that gym, it's a nice gym, were over the moon. I was in love with the gym. I wanted to marry the gym. And now I just really like the gym, but I don't have the feeling of astonishment. No. And that's what the book is about. That's about habituation. And our conversation will make me more amazed at the gym next time I go, which I hope is tomorrow, by virtue of the fact that I've reminded myself that I get to go to a gym.
Well, again, the book is called Look Again, The Power of Noticing What Was Always There, which you wrote with Tali Sharot, and she's quite a celebrated neuroscientist at, I believe, both at MIT and University College London. So I want to just take a bridge from where we were to some other concerns, which some of what you actually do, you do touch on some of this in the book. There's a section on misinformation and I think conspiracy thinking, but I mean, one thing I'm worried that we're getting habituated to is total dysfunction and toxic partisanship in our politics, and just a failure to have a fact-based discussion about anything of consequence, given that our entire population appears to be siloed into incompatible data sets with respect to, I mean, most of this is happening on social media, but I guess it's even a bigger problem than that, just in terms of the kinds of information sources that the various echo chambers consider to be sources of information. And there's a very perverse effect here where when you look at what a government can do to respond to misinformation and conspiracy thinking, there's a kind of paradox because many of the most inflammatory pieces of misinformation, many of the most inflammatory and polarizing conspiracy theories relate to the government's very efforts to respond to misinformation and conspiracy thinking, right? So they, like, anytime the government has reached out to a social media organization trying to get them to dampen down some crackpot thesis that may well be getting people killed, let's say during a pandemic, that is now, you know, exhibit A in the Orwellian overreach of our government that is, you know, suggests that, you know, everything, that the pandemic itself was entirely fake to some people and just a pretext to seize control of the levers of power. Give me your view of our current state of polarization and discombobulation, and what are we going to do about it?
Okay, great. So let's talk about the habituation part. There's something called the illusory truth effect, and I'm going to illustrate it right now. I'm not sure if you heard, Sam, that recently Tom Brady announced he was going to run for governor, and what he said was that he, by virtue of his football career, he's met a lot of people, he has some sense of what America's like, he is used to being in the public eye, and so running for governor for him, for Tom Brady, seems to be not an unnatural place to go. Brady isn't a particularly political person, he says, but running for governor does fit with his desire to use whatever public positive impression he's had to help people and to pay back. Okay, I just lied, and I lied three times. Tom Brady is not running for governor, but I deliberately said it three times. And the reason is to illustrate the illusory truth effect, which is if people hear something repeated, they are more likely to believe it's true. And if it is denied in the context of even stating it, then the fact is that many people will even so believe it's true.
Yeah.
So the illusory truth effect is one of the easiest things to demonstrate in laboratory experiments. It's so strong, it's so powerful, that if you say something two or three times or four times, people, every demographic group, they're more likely to believe it's true than if they hear it for the first time.
Which means some percentage of our audience, despite the fact that you raised this example only to debunk it, will remember at some point, perhaps months and years hence, that Tom Brady once flirted with the idea of running for governor.
Yeah, even I'm afraid I'm going to think that Tom Brady's running for governor, though I'm the one who made it up. And this needs an explanation. Here's the explanation: that if you hear something you haven't heard before, it's hard to process. There's a surprise signal in the brain, and you're kind of thinking it through, and it's a little stuck. If you've heard something several times, let's say a shrimp's heart is in its head, oh, that's surprising. I think actually it's true, but don't take that to the bank. I'm not doing anything intentionally here, but I'm not sure it's true. Or if you hear that vitamin C cures the cold or prevents you from, makes it less likely you'll get the cold, then just hearing it, it's really easy to process. And there's a kind of heuristic in the mind: easier, truthier. And that isn't the worst thing, kind of in terms of human evolution. If you're in a neighborhood and you keep hearing there are to the northeast tigers, stay away from there, or that if you go in this direction, you'll hit quicksand, and you hear both of those things twice, to believe them is probably useful for survival. But on social media, of course, falsehoods are repeated over and over and over and over again. And that means the illusory truth effect turns out to be really damaging to multiple things, including our ability to live together. So take that as one, and take the second to be the echo chamber effect, which you're describing, where if you have people who are sorting themselves into communities of like-minded types, they will end up being more unified, more confident, and more extreme by virtue of the fact that they're talking mostly with one another. Mm. And even if they're talking to some extent with others, it's to think of them not as fellow citizens in a communication process, but as horrible enemies whom it's good to listen to just to see how horrible they are. And I actually have data from an experiment I did in Colorado where we got people to the left of center to talk about various issues together and people from the right of center to talk about various issues together. And before they talked just with one another, the people on the left were not in violent disagreement with the people on the right. They were oriented in a different direction in these issues, but they were in the same political universe. After the people from Colorado Springs talked to each other, they went whoosh to the right. They became unified, confident, and extreme. And the people from Boulder went whoosh to the left. It's just a matter of 20, 25 minutes of conversation. The people in Boulder became, you know, real lefties on the issues we had them talk about, unified, extreme, confident. And after they talked to each other, if we put the people in from Colorado Springs together with people from Boulder, they would have looked at each other as if they were from another planet on these issues. And social media is doing a version of our Colorado experiment every day. And that's devastatingly destructive to democracy and to, let's say, respectful interaction. Because the people on the left, having spoken and listened to people only on the left, once they encounter people on the right who've been speaking and listening only to people on the right, will think these are aliens, not these are fellow citizens. And this will be mutually true. And it's regrettable that the Colorado experiment, which we created in order to test how groups interacting with like-minded others would end up, is actually being replicated in different versions every second of every day on social media.
Mm.
That's profoundly worrisome. And if you put the—
I'll just add one thing here. It's almost worse than that, because it's not just that these two groups are siloed and not getting input from the other group. They are getting inputs from the other group, but they're using those inputs as points. I mean, if you take Twitter, you know, X as an example, they may be following people who they despise and want to ridicule, and they're reacting to their content in front of their group. I mean, they are still effectively siloed because they're just dunking on things and retweeting things to the people who are following them, which is their in-group, but they're doing it to deride the out-group. And you know, just engaging in what is almost always a bad faith, you know, pseudo conversation with the out group, and so it's just the contact that is being made is derisive and used to signal to the in group and to push it further into its own extreme.
Completely, yeah. And it's like, look at the cockroach.
Yeah.
So you know you're of one view, and then you hear someone from another view. And instead of pausing and thinking, is there anything in that, you say, look at the cockroach. And that's horrible. And it's connected with habituation, because what you believe is super easy to process. And it feels easy. It's like a liquid going down the throat very easily. What you don't believe triggers a kind of surprise signal that is not, hooray, the sun came out and it's so bright, but instead, look at the horrible sleet that is hitting my house.
Yeah. Your comments on the illusory truth effect are relevant to my own research in graduate school, because I did functional neuroimaging studies on belief and disbelief. And one thing we found, and this to some degree explains the illusory truth effect, is that merely understanding a statement, I mean, if I gave you a sentence to read, you're merely comprehending it. Or, you know, if I speak a sentence, you know, that, as you did, you know, Tom Brady is planning to run for governor, simply comprehending that leaves one tacitly granting it credence. I mean, you're like, your default is to accept it as true, and your rejecting it as false is a further operation. And one
wow.
clear behavioral sign of this is just, if you give people matched statements for, you know, the equally complex statements, true and false, you'll find that they are, you know, reliably quicker to answer true to true statements than false to false statements, even if they're the same degree of complexity. So you give someone the equation 2 + 2 = 4, they will say yes, true, faster than if you give them the equation 2 + 2 = 5, they will get to no, false. Their complexity is the same, and yet it's just there's a further move you have to make to detect the error and report it.
That's fascinating. Yeah, that's closely related.
So how are you thinking about this year of great consequence in American politics? It's 2024. We have multiple wars that we are supporting to one or another degree or failing to support. America's place in the world seems to be something we are at least struggling to figure out what our national attitude is. How are you viewing the political landscape and the way in which our failures to communicate effectively to one another, to say nothing of persuade one another of important things. How is that playing out, and what do you see us doing about it in any time frame so as to improve things?
I have two orientations. One is Abraham Lincoln is said to have said to one of his advisors, I don't like that man. I must get to know him better. So I have that as kind of a defining thing for myself, that if there are people whom I'm tempted to think I don't like, I think I probably should get to know them better. And the other is from a psychologist named Amos Tversky, who said, I'm an optimist, and it's rational to be an optimist, because if you're a pessimist, you suffer twice.
Mm.
I think it's very funny, right? You suffer once when the terrible thing happens, and before that, you suffer when you're thinking about it. So in terms of what to do, I think each of us, you know, we may have something we can do in our work, in our community, which involve maybe small acts of charity, of efforts at mutual understanding, of insisting on the importance of truth. Maybe that's a foundational thing. And part of what we find in our book, which is the most chilling part of the book, I think, is that if people lie, if they're incentivized to lie, the amygdala in the brain will fire, be activated in their first lying. That is the part of the brain that involves emotional processing. People hate their own lying, but it will quiet down after a while. If you lie like a bunch of times over the course of the day, this is regular people, not like sociopaths or liars. They lie a bunch, and then the amygdala quiets, and then they're lying more because they don't get the red light from the brain. And so I think to insist on values of truth-telling, of democratic civility, of fond and warm rebukes rather than rage and dismissal. Now, there is a place for rage. Of course, there's a place for rage. That, I think, is foundational. Also, I'm haunted, and the book talks about this, with the rise of fascism in Germany, which happened in part, it was kind of too perfect for our book, that people said at the time, one person who was a very prominent discussant of the rise of Nazism referred to the gradual habituation of the people.
Mm-hmm.
And the thought was, if Hitler had been his Hitlerness on the first day, it would have all collapsed for him, or even in the first month, or even in the first 4 months. It was gradual ramping up of fascism. And while I don't think that the United States or European nations are anything like on the verge of fascism, I think you're quite right that there are warning signs in terms of division and a lack of fidelity to truth that need attention like now, not 2 years from now. And in some ways, the book is meant as a contribution, not to any particular political view, but to fidelity to, let's say, principles of mutual respect and being dishabituated to things that violate those ideals.
What, if anything, can or should governments do? I guess I'm most focused on our own government, to mitigate misinformation and conspiracy thinking when it's of consequence.
I'm speaking in my capacity as an academic. I also have a role with the U.S. government. And so those issues, I would defer to people who are speaking publicly about those things. I'm a part-time bureaucrat who is thinking broadly of academic things, not of...
Right. But I mean, I guess I'm concerned that we're now in an environment where any effort to mitigate misinformation is, on its face, thought to be further evidence of, you know, some sinister government overreach, right? That there is nothing, you know, for a considerable part of the population. I don't know if it's half of America, but it's got to be something close to half. There is absolutely no role, no conceivable role for the government to put its hand on the scale when you're talking about the spread of information on social media, right? I mean, COVID proved to half the country that anything the government's going to do to try to gatekeep around information is purpose toward aggregating power and is in principle malicious and against the interests of ordinary Americans. And it's just that, I mean, there's so many conspiracies built up around this that, you know, I fear that if we had a pandemic quite a bit more consequential than COVID, we would be just helpless to solve the most obvious coordination problems, because the mere announcement of the pandemic would be met with skepticism on the part of at least 50% of our society at this point, and to say nothing of any steps we would take to mitigate it.
Well, a few thoughts. One is to build up from areas where, let's say, private or public institutions are credible. So if you go to an airport and there are signs saying, here's the gate and here's the restroom and here's where you go if you want to, you know, get medical help or whatever.
Here's the room where Tom Hanks and Oprah Winfrey are cannibalizing children and taking adrenochrome from their bodies.
There's unlikely to be that at Reagan Airport or at Logan. So if you go to airports, there are things that are all over that people say, okay, they trust that. And there are many things in a city, take your pick, where public officials say various things. If they say there's a snow day today, so don't go to school, people aren't thinking they're lying.
Right.
The schools are open and they're just trying to keep me out. Or if people say, actually, the schools are open today, notwithstanding the snow, people don't say they're trying to trick me. So to think, what are the characteristics of the things which are really daily, where either prominent private or actually public officials say things and they are credible? If there are notices about there's going to be a flood or there's going to be extreme heat today, so there are things to be done, or there's wildfire, people don't say they're joking, it's going to be 70 degrees, it's not going to be 98.
Except we did have a president who got out his own Sharpie and redirected a hurricane on a national weather map.
That's impressive. Sharpies have magical powers sometimes. So I wonder, what are the characteristics of the, you know, multiple things that are said that people say, okay, that's probably true? If people tell you a street is closed, don't go there, you don't think they're lying, that street is open. Or at least it's very rare to think that. So, and there's actually some research that shows that there are a wide range of factual corrections. This isn't from like yesterday, but it's not super recent, but it's pretty recent. That if corrections are given, to the surprise, I think, of many people who research this stuff, if there's a correction of a statement about unemployment or immigration or health, the correction is believed both by Republicans and Democrats. Most of them believe the correction, even if it flies in the face of what they thought before. Now, why is that? It's because the people who are providing the correction have credibility as not associated with a particular side. Now, it may be that that's diminished, but they're now compared to 5 years ago, and it might be the fact that if it's the federal government, there might be an association with a particular person. But if an agency says something about weather conditions or spiking unemployment rates in, you know, take your pick of place, the thought isn't they're lying. The thought is, oh. And that, I think that's still generally true. And I think I know what you're thinking, Sam, if I may say, that there's so many domains where the statement, whether it's about health or something, is so associated with the other side that the person who hears it says, like kind of in a country whose government is completely untrustworthy, of course they would say that. And that is true. That's a problem. And to work on it, I think we should build from those cases where the problem is either small or solved. And I just gave a bunch of examples where, you know, people at the airport aren't thinking, I'm a man, I'm going to go to the woman's room, because they're lying about which is which.
I guess related question that around the loss of trust in institutions, I'm thinking now in particular about our nation's universities and especially our finer universities. You know, in the aftermath of October 7th and, you know, recent eruptions of anti-Semitism on campus and the disastrous congressional hearings with the college presidents, I notice you've been associated with two universities which are actually on the opposite ends of the spectrum with respect to how they are judged to have successfully navigated this moment and protected free speech and been consistent in the application of that protection. So the University of Chicago has been singled out as like the one good school that has said something sane on this topic, basically announcing at some point that they're not going to get in the business of declaring their opposition to every single atrocity that hits the front page of the New York Times. Just rest assured that if it was an atrocity, we were not for it. And, you know, we'll get back to educating students now and allowing for conversation, no matter how polarizing, to take place in a civilized manner. And then you've also been associated with Harvard, which has distinguished itself as the, according to FIRE's recent rating, as the university that has the least free speech in America of those rated. I think it was like the bottom of 300 assessed. And, you know, as we saw before, Congress really couldn't be prevented from putting both feet in its mouth around the obvious double standards to which certain types of threatening speech were held. I mean, it was just the thing that was so galling about the, you know, Claudine Gay's testimony. It was not that expressions of overt anti-Semitism could only be judged against university policy in context, but it was just patently obvious that had anything had, like what had happened in recent weeks around anti-Semitism, if the same expressions of hatred and intolerance had been directed at blacks or, you know, trans students, that there would have been zero tolerance for it. And everyone knew that, and it was just impossible to deny that. So it was the double standard and the hypocrisy that drove everyone nuts. What's your sense of the scope of this crisis in the ivory tower, and what are your thoughts about what university presidents and administrators and professors, what should academics do in response to what is currently a seemingly an unacceptable status quo?
Well, I can say that I teach at Harvard, and I teach a very large undergraduate class and several law school classes. And the willingness of students to speak freely is self-evident. And I have classes where there are people very right of center and they speak out and they're amazing. And I have classes where people are very left of center and they speak out and are amazing. It might be the case that there are some people right of center, some people left of center who feel that they shouldn't say what they think, but there's extraordinary and inspiring diversity of view. And I had one course on the Supreme Court where the conservative students were extremely vocal and very impressive. And what was really cool, the technical word is, I detected no feeling on the part of the left of center students that they should shut up, that the conservative students should shut up. Instead, what I detected, and this is all I detected, was a sense of the left of center students, that the right of center students are wrong, and here's why. And that was really admirable. So,
but for instance, I think it would be, you'd win a lot of money in a casino if you could place bets on this. You get some right of center, you know, prominent right of center person, let's say, you know, Ben Shapiro, to hold an event at Harvard. There's going to be protest at Harvard, and the protest might be such that the event will be canceled. There's a record of cancellation of, I mean, at one point, I mean, Condoleezza Rice was canceled from somewhere. I think that might have been Stanford. I mean, it's just, there's a level of intolerance expressed for right-wing views in some of our finer universities that is, you know, fairly bewildering given, I mean, this is not a fascist being invited to campus, but just somebody who is right of center and given to saying provocative things.
Let's talk about what's right, what should happen, and then we can talk about what does happen. So to be habituated to a system of, let's say, intolerance and suppression would be a very bad thing. And to be insistent on, either because you're habituated to it or because you're not, on a culture of openness and welcoming of competing views, that's necessary for learning. So there might be competing views about how to understand Shakespeare. Let's not talk about politics at all. Let's talk about how to understand Shakespeare, or competing views about what accounts for the American Revolution that might be politicized or maybe not much, or competing views about whether Roe against Wade was rightly decided, or whether the Roberts course is marking the right line, or whether it's doing something horrific. So I think it should be bedrock that universities should welcome those competing views, and Harvard Law School really does, and the University of Chicago Law School really does. So that's a fact. If there are deviations from that at Chicago or Harvard, that's something that's a problem. to be fixed.
Well, wasn't there, it's Stanford Law I'm thinking about, where there was a conservative judge who got hectored by a very left-wing group of students, and then they brought in some DEI administrator to further hector him. Do you remember, do you know what the case I'm talking about?
I do, vaguely. That's California, that's so far away. Right, yeah. I barely understand what happens in California. Yeah. Isn't it sunny there all the time? That's not good for the soul.
Yeah, well, so, we habituate to it.
But I do know that incident. That was very, very disturbing. Mm. So I think in terms of the principle, I'm not sure what the right form of words is, but the right response to ideas we hate is counterargument, not suppression. Justice Brandeis said something like that. And a university is, in a way, a foundation for the people who attend for democratic citizenship. And it's a terrible foundation if people who think things are feeling they can't talk, or if people who are invited are silenced because they have a view that's unwelcome. That's extremely terrible. Now, to protest, you know, suppose Senator Sanders shows up at the University of Texas or the University of Mississippi. People don't like him very much. They don't like socialism very much. And they have signs saying socialism stinks, or, you know, they tried it in Russia and look what happened there. That's completely fine. So protests are fine. But to shut down an invited speaker, that should be in violation of norms. And as much as we embrace freedom of speech, and I think First Amendment principles are a pretty good foundation even for private universities to follow, the First Amendment principles don't allow you to stop other people from speaking. So to say you can't do that is not inconsistent with First Amendment principles. So I agree with that. What I just don't know is whether the degree of intolerance, let's say, though maybe that's too friendly a word, for right-of-center views on university campuses is sufficiently present that we have a crisis. I haven't observed anything like that. So I was at a conference not long ago at Harvard, which was mostly a very right-of-center conference, and no one did anything negative. I'm going, I think, in 7 days to the Federalist Society conference. I'm honored to be speaking at the Federalist Society conference, which is a right-of-center conference. Mm. And I haven't heard anyone say, and there's a very conservative judge who's sharing the keynote event with me. I'm honored to participate with him. And no one's saying that that judge, who is, he's quite right-of-center. I talked to him. I liked him a lot. He seems like a very impressive guy. He is, you know, people left of center could be very agitated that he's present, and I haven't heard a single person saying anything negative. Mm. So my own experience, and again, this is not data, is that at Harvard Law School, if you have an argument and you're invited, no one's going to tell you to go home. They might not like your presence, and maybe they'll have a sign up. If they try to stop you from speaking, well, then you should be stopped from stopping people from speaking.
Hmm. I think one of the cases that was still ringing in everyone's memory when Claudine Gay gave her testimony was that a geologist who had a talk canceled because it was revealed that he, in some other moment, had voiced skepticism about whether DEI proclamations were, you know, was something that university professors should be obliged to sign. Right. So there are things like, there are moments like that, which may not be representative of what's happening campus-wide all the time, but they are perhaps the exception to the rule that just proves that there's no...
I hope so. I mean, I feel I don't have enough data, but I think that the concern about canceling or suppressing speech that people don't agree with, that's a really good thing. It suggests people haven't habituated to that form of, let's say, and again, I think intolerance is too weak a word, that form of censorship may be too strong a word, but closer to that. Mm. And I'm smiling a little bit that the idea that people who are skeptical of DEI would be forbidden from speaking isn't very D, and it isn't very E, and it isn't very I.
Yeah, yeah. That irony has been noted. Moving to politics and tapping your expertise as a constitutional scholar, what do you think about the current cases arrayed against Trump and the various efforts to keep him off the ballot as an insurrectionist? Is all or most of this counterproductive? Do you think some of it really should be accomplished because it's just legally straightforward and should be decisive? I mean, can you make pass judgment on the quality of these efforts and their constitutionality?
Well, I confess that since I've been focused so much on behavioral science and habituation and kind of my day jobs, the intricacies of the law cases haven't been one I haven't engaged much in them. So I would say that the insurrectionist arguments originated in a law review paper by respected scholars. And there are arguments that people are making that are very much within the ballpark of the good faith legal arguments. And I don't have myself a settled view about how to think of them.
I guess a final question here. What most concerns you going forward? I mean, again, many of us are perceiving 2024 to be an unusually fraught year, both domestically and internationally. What are you paying attention to, and if anything, are you hopeful about? Are there positive trends you see here that you think were some of the doomsayers are exaggerating the peril they perceive?
Well, I'll tell you what I'm personally most focused on, which is that there's a tradition, let's call it liberalism, which is associated with John Stuart Mill and Friedrich Hayek and John Rawls and Milton Friedman, which is something that Ronald Reagan was emphatically part of and something that Franklin Delano Roosevelt was emphatically part of for all of their differences. And what I'm focused on is the liberal tradition is something more than honorable. It's like a shining star in the sky, and that it's under extremely serious pressure, both from political life and also from theoretical circles. So connected with our discussion of campus stuff, there is illiberalism on some campuses. I like to think that it's minor and marginal, but that is a hopeful view. There is on the right as well as on the left a set of illiberal forces, which is very threatening to the core of what makes our country so amazing. And what I see as imperative is a joining of the hands of the liberals, not the few, the brave, the Marines, but the many, the increasingly brave, and the Marine adjacent, who are insistent that across whatever political differences we have, we're part of an American tradition that we want to retain. I find myself much more upbeat about people on the right with whom I've had fierce disagreements over time because they are liberal, not in the sense of left of center, they aren't, but because they're part of the liberal tradition. And that hand joining on the part of those who like the New Deal and really don't, but don't much like communism or fascism or authoritarianism, that I see as an avenue for recovery.
Do you see signs that we're pulling back from the brink there, or does it all await an election in November?
I think Yogi Berra was right when he said predictions are hard, especially about the future. So what's going to happen? Who would have expected, you know, COVID? Who would have expected someone named Barack Hussein Obama would be president? Who would have expected Donald Trump would be president? Who would have expected, well, maybe some would have, but what's happening in Ukraine right now? Many of these things are stunning surprises, and some of them are to many surprising. And so how things are going to go, I don't know. I think the best we can do is identify good paths and try to make them a little easier to trod.
Well, Cass, always great to talk to you. Thank you for your time, and best of luck with the book.
Great pleasure. Great to talk to you, Sam.